The Two Towers, Disc 3.
At last Mary stirred and whispered softly, "So far so good, but how are we to avoid being spitted?" The answer came almost immediately. The cries of Grishnak had roused the orcs. From the yells and screeches that came from the knoll, the hobbits guessed that their disappearance had been discovered. Ugluk was probably knocking off a few more heads. Then suddenly the answering cries of orc voices came from the right, outside the circle of watchfires, from the direction of the forest and the mountains. Mahua had apparently arrived and was attacking the besiegers. There was the sound of galloping horses. The riders were drawing in their ring close round the knoll, risking the orc arrows so as to prevent any sortie, while a company rode off to deal with the newcomers. Suddenly Merry and Pippin realized that without moving they were now outside the circle. There was nothing between them and escape. "Now," said Merry, "if only we had our legs and hands free, we might get away. But I can't touch the knots, and I can't bite them."
"No need to try," said Pippin. "I was going to tell you. I've managed to free my hands. These loops are only left for show. You'd better have a bit of lembas first."
He slipped the cords off his wrists and fished out a packet. The cakes were broken, but good, still in their leaf wrappings. The hobbits each ate two or three pieces. The taste brought back to them the memory of fair faces and laughter and wholesome food in quiet days now far away. For a while they ate thoughtfully, sitting in the dark, heedless of the cries and sounds of battle nearby. Pippin was the first to come back to the present.
"We must be off," he said. "Half a moment."
Grishnak's sword was lying close at hand, but it was too heavy and clumsy for him to use, so he crawled forward, and finding the body of the goblin, he drew from its sheath a long, sharp knife. With this he quickly cut their bonds.
"Now for it," he said. "When we've warmed up a bit, better we shall be able to stand again and walk. But in any case, we'd better start by crawling."
They crawled. The turf was deep and yielding, and that helped them, but it seemed a long, slow business. They gave the watchfire a wide berth and wormed their way forward bit by bit until they came to the edge of the river, gurgling away in the black shadows under its deep banks. Then they looked about. The sounds had died away. Evidently, Mohor and his lads had been killed or driven off. The riders had returned to their silent, ominous vigil. It wouldn't last very much longer. Already the night was old. In the east, which had remained unclouded, the sky was beginning to grow pale.
"We must get under cover," said Pippin, "or we shall be seen."
"It'll not be any comfort to us if these riders discover that we're not orcs after we're dead."
He got up and stamped his feet.
"Those cords have cut me like wires, but my feet are getting warm again. I could stagger on now.
What about you, Merry?"
Merry got up.
"Yes," he said, "I can manage it. Lembas does put heart into you. A more wholesome sort of feeling, too, than the heat of the orc draught. I wonder what it was made of.
Better not to know, I expect. Let's get a drink of water to wash away the thought of it."
"Not here. The banks are too steep," said Pippin. "Forward now."
They turned and walked side by side slowly along the line of the river. Behind them the light grew in the east. As they walked, they compared notes, talking lightly in hobbit fashion of the things that had happened since their capture. No listener would have guessed from their words that they had suffered cruelly and been in dire peril, going without hope towards torment and death, or that even now, as they well knew, they had little chance of ever finding friend or safety again.
"You seem to have been doing well, Master Took," said Merry. "You will get almost a chapter in old Bilbo's book, if ever I get a chance to report to him. Good work, especially guessing that hairy villain's little game and playing up to him. But I wonder if anyone will ever pick up your trail and find that brooch. I should hate to lose mine, but I'm afraid yours has gone for good." I shall have to brush up my toes if I'm to get level with you. Indeed, Cousin Brandybuck is going in front now. This is where he comes in. I don't suppose you've much notion where we are, but I spent my time at Rivendell rather better. We're walking west along the Entwash. The butt end of the mountains is in front, and Fangorn Forest. Even as he spoke, the dark edge of the forest loomed up straight before them. Night seemed to have taken refuge under its great trees, creeping away from the coming dawn. "Lead on, Master Brandybuck," said Pippin, "or lead back. We have been warned against Fangorn, but one so knowing will not have forgotten that." "I haven't," answered Merry, "but the forest seems better to me all the same than turning back into the middle of a battle." He led the way in under the huge branches of the trees. Old beyond guessing, they seemed. Great trailing beards of lichen hung from them, blowing and swaying in the breeze. Out of the shadows the hobbits peeped, gazing back down the slope. Little furtive figures that in the dim light looked like elf children in the deeps of time, peering out of the wild wood in wonder at their first dawn. Far over the great river and the brown lands, leagues upon grey leagues away, the dawn came, red as flame. Loud rang the hunting horns to greet it. The riders of Rohan sprang suddenly to life. Horn answered horn again. Merry and Pippin heard, clear in the cold air, the neighing of war horses and the sudden singing of many men. The sun's limb was lifted, an arc of fire above the margin of the world. Then with a great cry the riders charged from the east. The red light gleamed on mail and spear. The orcs yelled and shot all the arrows that remained to them. The hobbits saw several horsemen fall, but their line held on up the hill and over it, and wheeled round and charged again. Most of the raiders that were left alive then broke and fled, this way and that, pursued one by one to the death. But one band, holding together in a black wedge, drove forward resolutely in the direction of the forest. Straight up the slope they charged, towards the watchers. Now they were drawing near, and it seemed certain that they would escape. They'd already hewn down three riders that barred their way. "We've watched too long," said Merry. "There's a Glück. I don't want to meet him again." The hobbits turned and fled deep into the shadows of the wood. So it was that they did not see the last stand when a Glück was overtaken and brought to bay at the very edge of Fangorn. There he was slain at last by Eomer, the third marshal of the Mark, who dismounted and fought him sword to sword. And over the wide fields the keen-eyed riders hunted down the few orcs that had escaped and still had strength to fly. Then, when they had laid their fallen comrades in a mound and had sung their praises, the riders made a great fire and scattered the ashes of their enemies. So ended the raid, and no news of it came ever back, either to Mordor or to Isengard. But the smoke of the burning rose high to heaven and was seen by many watchful eyes. Chapter 4. Treebeard. Meanwhile the hobbits went with as much speed as the dark and tangled forest allowed, following the line of the running stream, westward and up towards the slopes of the mountains, deeper and deeper into Fangorn. Slowly their fear of the orcs died away, and their pace slackened. A queer stifling feeling came over them, as if the air were too thin or too scanty for breathing. At last Merry halted. "We can't go on like this," he panted. "I want some air." "Let's have a drink at any rate," said Pippin. "I'm parched." He clambered on to a great tree root that wound down into the stream, and stooping, drew up some water in his cupped hands. It was clear and cold, and he took many draughts. Merry followed him. The water refreshed them, and seemed to cheer their hearts. For a while they sat together on the brink of the stream, dabbling their sore feet and legs, and peering round at the trees that stood silently about them, rank upon rank, until they faded away into grey twilight in every direction. "I suppose you haven't lost us already," said Pippin, leaning back against the great tree trunk. "We can at least follow the course of this stream, the Entwash, or whatever you call it, and get out again the way we came."
"We could, if our legs would do it," said Merry, "and if we could breathe properly."
"Yes, it's all very dim and stuffy in here," said Pippin. "It reminds me somehow of the old room in the great place of the Tooks, away back in the Smiles of Tuckborough, a huge place where the furniture has never been moved or changed for generations. They say the old Took lived in it year after year, while he and the room got older and shabbier together, and it has never changed since he died, a century ago. And old Gerontius was my great-great-grandfather. That puts it back a bit. But that is nothing to the old feeling of this wood. Look at all those weeping, trailing beards and whiskers of lichen. And most of the trees seem to be half covered with ragged, dry leaves that have never fallen. Untidy. I can't imagine what spring would look like here, if it ever comes, still less a spring cleaning."
"But the sun at any rate must peep in sometimes," said Merry. "It doesn't look or feel at all like Bilbo's description of Mirkwood. That was all dark and black, and the home of dark black things. This is just dim and frightfully treeish. You can't imagine animals living here at all, or staying for long."
"No, nor hobbits," said Pippin, "and I don't like the thought of trying to get through it either. Nothing to eat for 100 miles, I should guess. How are our supplies?"
"Lo," said Merry, "we ran off with nothing but a couple of spare packets of lembas, and left everything else behind." They looked at what remained of the elven cakes. "Broken fragments for about 5 meagre days, that was all."
"And not a wrap or a blanket," said Merry. "We shall be cold tonight whichever way we go."
"Well, we'd better decide on the way now," said Pippin. "The morning must be getting on."
Just then they became aware of a yellow light that had appeared, some way further on into the wood. Shafts of sunlight seemed suddenly to have pierced the forest roof.
"Hallo," said Merry. "The sun must have run into a cloud while we've been under these trees, and now she's run out again, or else she's climbed high enough to look down through some opening. It isn't far. Let's go and investigate."
They found it was further than they thought. The ground was rising steeply still, and it was becoming increasingly stony. The light grew broader as they went on, and soon they saw that there was a rock wall before them, the side of a hill, or the abrupt end of some long route thrust out by the distant mountains. No trees grew on it, and the sun was falling full on its stony face. The twigs of the trees at its foot were stretched out stiff and still, as if reaching out to the warmth. Where all had looked so shabby and grey before, the wood now gleamed with rich browns and with the smooth black greys of bark like polished leather. The boles of the trees glowed with a soft green like young grass. Early spring or a fleeting vision of it was about them. In the face of the stony wall there was something like a stair, natural perhaps, and made by the weathering and splitting of the rock, for it was rough and uneven. High up, almost level with the tops of forest trees, there was a shelf under a cliff. Nothing grew there but a few grasses and weeds at its edge, and one old stump of a tree with only 2 bent branches left. It looked almost like the figure of some gnarled old man standing there, blinking in the morning light.
"Up we go," said Merry joyfully. "Now for a breath of air and a sight of the land."
They climbed and scrambled up the rock. If the stair had been made, it was for bigger feet and longer legs than theirs. They were too eager to be surprised at the remarkable way in which the cuts and sores of their captivity had healed and their vigour had returned. They came at length to the edge of the shelf, almost at the feet of the old stump. Then they sprang up and turned round with their backs to the hill, breathing deep and looking eastward. They saw that they had only come 3 or 4 miles into the forest. The heads of the trees marched down the slope towards the plain. There, near the fringe of the forest, tall spires of curling black smoke went up, waving and floating towards them.
"The wind's changing," said Merry. "'It's turned east again. "'It feels cool up here.'
"'Yes,' said Pippin. "'I'm afraid this is only a passing gleam, "'and it'll all go grey again. "'What a pity. "'This shaggy old forest looks so different in the sunlight. "'I almost felt I liked the place.'
"'Almost felt you liked the forest? "'That's good. "'That's uncommonly kind of you,'
said a strange voice.
"'Turn round and let me have a look at your faces. "'I almost feel that I dislike you both. "'But do not let us be hasty. "'Turn round.'
"'A large, knob-knuckled hand was laid on each of their shoulders, "'and they were twisted round, gently but irresistibly. "'Then two great arms lifted them up. "'They found that they were looking at a most extraordinary face.' It belonged to a large man-like, almost troll-like figure, at least 14 feet high, very sturdy, with a tall head and hardly any neck. Whether it was clad in stuff like green and grey bark, or whether that was its hide, was difficult to say. At any rate the arms, at a short distance from the trunk, were not wrinkled, but covered with a brown, smooth skin. The large feet had 7 toes each. The lower part of the long face was covered with a sweeping grey beard, bushy, almost twiggy at the roots, thin and mossy at the ends. But at the moment the hobbits noted little but the eyes. These deep eyes were now surveying them, slow and solemn, but very penetrating. They were brown, shot with a green light. Often afterwards Pippin tried to describe his first impression of them. One felt as if there was an enormous well behind them, filled up with ages of memory and long, slow, steady thinking, but their surface was sparkling with a present, like sun shimmering on the outer leaves of a vast tree or on the ripples of a very deep lake. I don't know. But it felt as if something that grew in the ground, asleep, you might say, or just feeling itself as something between root-tip and leaf-tip, between deep earth and sky, had suddenly waked up, and was considering you with the same slow care that it had given to its own inside affairs for endless years.
Hum, hum,
murmured the voice, a deep voice like a very deep woodwind instrument.
Very odd indeed. Do not be hasty, that is my motto. But if I had seen you before I heard your voices, I liked them, nice little voices. They reminded me of something I cannot remember. If I had seen you before I heard you, I should have just trodden on you, taking you for little orcs, and found out my mistake afterwards. Very odd you are indeed, root and twig, very odd.
Pippin, though still amazed, no longer felt afraid. Under those eyes he felt a curious suspense, but not fear. "Please," he said, "who are you, and what are you?" A queer look came into the old eyes, a kind of wariness. The deep wells were covered over.
"Hum, now," answered the voice. "Well, I am an Ent, or that's what they call me. Yes, Ent. Is the word. The Ent I am, you might say, in your manner of speaking. Fangorn is my name, according to some. Treebeard, others make it. A Treebeard will do."
"An Ent?" said Merry. "What's that? But what do you call yourself? What's your real name?"
"Who, no," replied Treebeard. "Who? Now that would be telling, not so hasty. And I am doing the asking. You are in my country. What are you, I wonder? I cannot place you. You do not seem to come in the old list that I learned when I was young. But that was a long, long time ago, and they may have some new lists. Let me see. How did it go? Learn now the lore of living creatures. First name the four. The Free Peoples, eldest of all, the Elf Children, Dwarf the Delver, dark are his houses, Ent the Earthborn, old as mountains, Man the Mortal, Master of Horses, Beaver the Builder, Buck the Leaper, Bear Bee Hunter, Boar the Fighter, Hound is Hungry, Hare is Fearful, Eagle in Eyrie, Ox in Pasture, Hart Horn Crowned, Hawk is Swiftest, Swan the Whitest, Serpent Coldest. How did it go? Rum-tum, rum-tum, rum-ti-tum-tum. It was a long list, but anyway, you do not seem to fit in anywhere.
We always seem to have got left out of the old lists and the old stories, said Merry. Yet we've been about for quite a long time. We're hobbits. Why not make a new line, said Pippin. Half-grown hobbits, the hole dwellers. Put us in amongst the four, next to man, the big people, and you've got it.
Not bad, not bad, said Treebeard. That would do. So you live in holes, eh? It sounds very right and proper. Who calls you hobbits, though? That does not sound elvish to me. Elves made all the old words. They began it.
Nobody else calls us hobbits. We call ourselves that, said Pippin.
Come now, not so hasty. You call yourselves hobbits? But you should not go telling just anybody. You'll be letting out your own right names if you're not careful.
We aren't careful about that, said Merry. As a matter of fact, I'm a Brandybuck, Merryardock Brandybuck, though most people call me just Merry. And I'm a Took, Peregrine Took, but I'm generally called Pippin, or even Pip.
But you are hasty folk, I see, said Treebeard. I am honoured by your confidence, but you should not be too free all at once. There are Ents and Ents, you know, or there are Ents and things that look like Ents but ain't, as you might say. I'll call you Merry and Pippin, if you please, nice names, for I am not going to tell you my name, not yet at any rate.
A queer, half-knowing, half-humorous look came with a green flicker into his eyes.
For one thing, it would take a long while. My name is growing all the time, and I've lived a very long, long time, so my name is like a story. Real names tell you the story of the things they belong to in my language, in the old Entis, as you might say. It is a lovely language, but it takes a very long time to say anything in it, because we do not say anything in it unless it is worth taking a long time to say and to listen to. But now...
And the eyes became very bright and present, seeming to grow smaller and almost sharp.
What is going on? What are you doing in it all? I can see and hear... and smell and feel a great deal from this a-la-la-la-la-rumba-commanda-lindo-borumme. Excuse me, that is a part of my name for it. I do not know what the word is in the outside languages. You know, the thing we are on, where I stand and look out on fine mornings and think about the sun and the grass beyond the wood and the horses and the clouds and the unfolding of the world. What is going on? What is Gandalf up to? And these... Burrarum...
He made a deep rumbling noise like a discord on a great organ.
These orcs and young Saruman down at Isengard. I like news, but not too quick now.
There is quite a lot going on, said Merry, and even if we tried to be quick, it would take a long time to tell. But you told us not to be hasty. Ought we to tell you anything so soon? Would you think it rude if we asked what you were going to do with us, and which side you're on? And did you know Gandalf?
Yes, I do know him. The only wizard that really cares about trees, said Treebeard. Do you know him?
Yes, said Pippin sadly. We did. He was a great friend, and he was our guide.
Then I can answer your other questions, said Treebeard. I am not going to do anything with you, not if you mean by that do something to you without your leave. We might do some things together. I don't know about sides. I go my own way. But your way may go along with mine for a while. But you speak of Master Gandalf as if he was in a story that had come to an end.
Yes, we do, said Pippin sadly. The story seems to be going on, but I'm afraid Gandalf has fallen out of it.
Oh, come now, said Treebeard. Oh, well, he paused, looking long at the hobbits. Well, I do not know what to say. Come now.
If you would like to hear more, said Merry, we will tell you. But it'll take some time. Wouldn't you like to put us down? Couldn't we sit here together in the sun while it lasts? You must be getting tired of holding us up.
Tired? No, I am not tired. I do not easily get tired, and I do not sit down. I am not very, bendable. But there, the sun is going in. Let us leave this. Did you say what you call it?
Hill? Suggested Pippin. Shelf? Step? Suggested Merry. Treebeard repeated the words thoughtfully.
Hill. Yes, that was it. But it is a hasty word for a thing that has stood here ever since this part of the world was shaped. Never mind, let us leave it and go.
Where shall we go? Asked Merry.
To my home, or one of my homes, answered Treebeard.
Is it far?
I do not know. You might call it far, perhaps, but what does that matter?
Well, you see, we've lost all our belongings, said Merry. We have only a little food.
Oh, whom you need not trouble about that, said Treebeard. I can give you a drink that will keep you green and growing for a long, long while. And if we decide to part company, I can set you down outside my country at any point you choose. Let us go.
Holding the hobbits gently but firmly, one in the crook of each arm, Treebeard lifted up first one large foot and then the other, and moved them to the edge of the shelf. The root-like toes grasped the rocks. Then, carefully and solemnly, he stalked down from step to step and reached the floor of the forest. At once he set off with long, deliberate strides through the trees, deeper and deeper into the wood, never far from the stream, climbing steadily up towards the slopes of the mountains. Many of the trees seemed asleep, or as unaware of him as of any other creature that merely passed by. But some quivered, and some raised up their branches above his head as he approached. All the while, as he walked, he talked to himself in a long-running stream of musical sounds. The hobbits were silent for some time. They felt, oddly enough, safe and comfortable, and they had a great deal to think and wonder about. At last Pippin ventured to speak again.
"Please, Treebeard," he said, "could I ask you something? Why did Celeborn warn us against your forest? He told us not to risk getting entangled in it."
Did he know? Rumbled Treebeard. And I might have said much the same if you had been going the other way. Do not risk getting entangled in the woods of Laurel in Dornan. That is what the elves used to call it, but now they make the name shorter. Lothlorien, they call it. Perhaps they are right. Maybe it is fading, not growing. Land of the Valley of Singing Gold, that was it once upon a time. Now it is the Dream Flower. Oh, well. But it is a queer place, and not for just anyone to venture in. I am surprised that you ever got out, but much more surprised that you ever got in. That has not happened to strangers for many a year. It is a queer land. And so is this. Folk have come to grief here. Aye, they have to grief. Laurel in Dorinan, Lindel Orendor, Malin Ornelian, Ornemalin, he hummed to himself. They are falling rather behind the world in there, I guess, he said. Neither this country nor anything else outside the Golden Wood is what it was when Celeborn was young. Still, Charele lomea tumbale morna tumbale taurea lomeanor. That is what they used to say. Things have changed, but it is still true in places.
What do you mean? Said Pippin. What is true?
The trees and the ants, said Treebeard. I do not understand all that goes on myself, so I cannot explain it to you. Some of us are still true ants, and lively enough in our fashion, but many are growing sleepy, going tree-ish, as you might say. Most of the trees are just trees, of course, but many are half awake. Some are quite wide awake, and a few are, well, getting entish. That is going on all the time. When that happens to a tree, you find that some have bad hearts. Nothing to do with their wood. I do not mean that. Why, I knew some good old fellows down the Entwash, gone long ago, alas. They were quite hollow. Indeed, they were falling all to pieces, but as quiet and sweet-spoken as a young leaf. And there are some trees in the valleys under the mountains, sound as a bell, and bad right through. That sort of thing seems to spread. There used to be some very dangerous parts in this country. There are still some very black patches.
Like the old forest away to the north, do you mean? Asked Mary.
Aye, something like, but much worse. I do not doubt there is some shadow of the great darkness lying there still away north, and bad memories are handed down. But there are hollow dales in this land where the darkness has never been lifted, and the trees are older than I am. Still, we do what we can. We keep off strangers and the foolhardy, and we train and we teach. We walk and we weed. We are tree herds, we old Ents. Few enough of us are left now. Sheep get like shepherd, and shepherds like sheep, it is said, but slowly, and neither have long in the world. It is quicker and closer with trees and Ents, and they walk down the ages together. For Ents are more like elves, less interested in themselves than men are, and better at getting inside other things. And yet again Ents are more like men, more changeable than elves are, and quicker at taking the colour of the outside, you might say, or better than both, for they are steadier and keep their minds on things longer. Some of my kin look just like trees now, and need something great to rouse them, and they speak only in whispers. But some of my trees are limb-lithe, and many can talk to me. Elves began it, of course, waking trees up and teaching them to speak and learning their tree talk. They always wished to talk to everything the old elves did. But then the great darkness came, and they passed away over the sea, or fled into far valleys and hid themselves, and made songs about days that would never come again, never again. Aye, there was all one wood once upon a time from here to the mountains of Loon, and this was just the east end. Those were the broad days. Time was when I could walk and sing all day and hear no more than the echo of my own voice in the hollow hills. The woods were like the woods of Lothlorien, only thicker, stronger, younger, and the smell of the air. I used to spend a week just breathing.
Treebeard fell silent, striding along, and yet making hardly a sound with his great feet. Then he began to hum again, and passed into a murmuring chant. Gradually the hobbits became aware that he was chanting to them.
In the willow meads of Tazarinan I walked in the spring. Ah, the sight and the smell of the spring in Nantasarion. And I said that was good. I wandered in summer in the elm woods of Osiriand. Ah, the light and the music in the summer by the seven rivers of Osir. And I thought that was best. To the beaches of Neldoreth I came in the autumn. Ah, the gold and the red and the sighing of leaves in the autumn in Tarna Neldor. It was more than my desire. To the pine trees upon the highland of Dorthonion I climbed in the winter. Ah, the wind and the whiteness and the black branches of winter upon Orodnathorn. My voice went up and sang in the sky, and now all those lands lie under the wave, and I walk in Umbarona, in Tara Morna, in Alda Lome, in my own land, in the country of Fangorn, where the roots are long, and the years lie thicker than the leaves in Tara Morna Lome.
He ended, and strode on silently, and in all the wood, as far as ear could reach, there was not a sound. The day waned, and dusk was twined about the boles of the trees. At last the hobbits saw, rising dimly before them, a steep, dark land. They had come to the feet of the mountains and to the green roots of tall methedras. Down the hillside the young Entwash, leaping from its springs high above, ran noisily from step to step to meet them. On the right of the stream there was a long slope, clad with grass, now grey in the twilight. No trees grew there, and it was open to the sky. Stars were shining already in lakes between the shores of cloud. Treebeard strode up the slope, hardly slackening his pace. Suddenly before them the hobbit saw a wide opening. Two great trees stood there, one on either side, like living gateposts, but there was no gate save their crossing and interwoven boughs. As the old Ent approached, the trees lifted up their branches, and all their leaves quivered and rustled. For they were evergreen trees, and their leaves were dark and polished, and gleamed in the twilight. Beyond them was a wide level space, as though the floor of a great hall had been cut in the side of the hill. On either hand of the walls sloped upwards, until they were 50 feet high or more, and along each wall stood an aisle of trees that also increased in height as they marched inwards. At the far end the rock wall was sheer, but at the bottom it had been hollowed back into a shallow bay with an arched roof. The only roof of the hall, save the branches of the trees, which at the inner end overshadowed all the ground, leaving only a broad open path in the middle. A little stream escaped from the springs above, and leaving the main water, fell tinkling down the sheer face of the wall, pouring in silver drops, like a fine curtain in front of the arched bay. The water was gathered again into a stone basin in the floor between the trees, and thence it spilled and flowed away beside the open path, out to rejoin the Entwash in its journey through the forest.
Here we are, said Treebeard, breaking his long silence. I have brought you about 70,000 Entstrides, but what that comes to in the measurement of your land I do not know. Anyway, we are near the roots of the last mountain. Part of the name of this place might be Welling Hall, if it were turned into your language. I like it. We will stay here tonight.
He set them down on the grass between the aisles of the trees, and they followed him towards the great arch. The hobbits now noticed that as he walked his knees hardly bent, but his legs opened in a great stride. He planted his big toes, and they were indeed big and very broad, on the ground first, before any other part of his feet. For a moment Treebeard stood under the rain of the falling spring, and took a deep breath. Then he laughed and passed inside. A great stone table stood near, but no chairs. At the back of the bay it was already quite dark. Treebeard lifted two great vessels and stood them on the table. They seemed to be filled with water, but he held his hands over them, and immediately they began to glow, one with a golden and the other with a rich green light, and the blending of the two lights lit the bay, as if the sun of summer was shining through a roof of young leaves. Looking back, the hobbit saw that the trees in the court had also begun to glow, faintly at first, but steadily quickening,
until every leaf was edged with light, some green, some gold, some red as copper, while the tree trunks looked like pillars moulded out of luminous stone.
"Well, well, now we can talk again," said Treebeard. "You are thirsty, I expect. Perhaps you are also tired. Drink this."
He went to the back of the bay, and then they saw that several tall stone jars stood there with heavy lids. He removed one of the lids and dipped in a great ladle, and with it filled three bowls, one very large and two smaller ones.
"This is an ent-house," he said, "and there are no seats, I fear, but you may sit on the table."
Picking up the hobbits, he set them on the great stone slab, 6 feet above the ground, and there they sat dangling their legs and drinking in sips.
The drink was like water, indeed very like the taste of the draughts they had drunk from the entwash near the borders of the forest, and yet there was some scent or savour in it which they could not describe. It was faint, but it reminded them of the smell of a distant wood borne from afar by a cool breeze at night. The effect of the draught began at the toes, and rose steadily through every limb, bringing refreshment and vigour as it coursed upwards, right to the tips of the hair. Indeed, the hobbits felt that the hair on their heads was actually standing up, waving and curling and growing. As for Treebeard, he first laved his feet in the basin beyond the arch, and then he drained his bowl at one draught, one long, slow draught. The hobbits thought he would never stop. At last he set the bowl down again.
"Ah," he sighed. "Now we can talk easier. You can sit on the floor, and I will lie down. That will prevent this drink from rising to my head and sending me to sleep."
On the right side of the bay there was a great bed on low legs, not more than a couple of feet high, covered deep in dried grass and bracken. Treebeard lowered himself slowly onto this, with only the slightest sign of bending at his middle, until he lay at full length, with his arms behind his head, looking up at the ceiling, upon which lights were flickering like the play of leaves in the sunshine. Merry and Pippin sat beside him on pillows of grass.
"Now tell me your tale, and do not hurry," said Treebeard.
The hobbits began to tell him the story of their adventures ever since they left Hobbiton. They followed no very clear order, for they interrupted one another continually, and Treebeard often stopped the speaker and went back to some earlier point, or jumped forward asking questions about later events. They said nothing whatever about the ring, and did not tell him why they set out or where they were going to, and he did not ask for any reasons. He was immensely interested in everything, in the Black Riders, in Elrond and Rivendell, in the Old Forest and Tom Bombadil, in the Mines of Moria, and in Lothlorien and Galadriel. He made them describe the Shire and its country over and over again. He said an odd thing at this point.
"You never see any ents round there, do you?" he asked. "Well, not ents. Ent-wives, I should really say."
"Ent-wives?" said Pippin. "Are they like you at all?"
"Yes, well, no. I do not really know now," said Treebeard thoughtfully. "But they would like your country, so I just wondered."
Treebeard was, however, especially interested in everything that concerned Gandalf, and most interested of all in Saruman's doings. The hobbits regretted very much that they knew so little about them, only a rather vague report by Sam of what Gandalf had told the council. But they were clear, at any rate, that Ugluk and his troop came from Isengard and spoke of Saruman as their master.
"Hum," said
Treebeard, when at last their story had wound and wandered down to the Battle of the Orcs and the Riders of Rohan.
"Well, well, that is a bundle of news and no mistake. You have not told me all, no, indeed, not by a long way. But I do not doubt that you are doing as Gandalf would wish. There is something very big going on, that I can see, and what it is maybe I shall learn in good time or in bad time. by root and twig, but it is a strange business. Up sprout a little folk that are not in the old lists, and behold, the 9 forgotten riders reappear to hunt them, and Gandalf takes them on a great journey, and Galadriel harbours them in Carras Galarthon, and orcs pursue them down all the leagues of Wilderland. Indeed, they seem to be caught up in a great storm. I hope they weather it.
And what about yourself? Asked Merry.
I have not troubled about the great wars, said Treebeard. They mostly concern elves and men. That is the business of wizards. Wizards are always troubled about the future. I do not like worrying about the future. I'm not altogether on anybody's side, because nobody is altogether on my side, if you understand me. Nobody cares for the woods as I care for them, not even elves nowadays. Still, I take more kindly to elves than to others. It was the elves that cured us of dumbness long ago, and that was a great gift that cannot be forgotten, though our ways have parted since. And there are some things, of course, whose side I am altogether not on. I am against them altogether, these Burrarum.
He again made a deep rumble of disgust.
These orcs and their masters. I used to be anxious when the shadow lay on Mirkwood, but when it removed to Mordor, I did not trouble for a while. Mordor is a long way away. But it seems that the wind is setting east, and the withering of all woods may be drawing near. There is naught that an old Ent can do to hold back that storm. He must weather it or crack. But Saruman now, Saruman is a neighbour. I cannot overlook him. I must do something, I suppose. I have often wondered lately what I should do about Saruman.
"'Who is Saruman?' asked Pippin. "'Do you know anything about his history?'
"'Saruman is a wizard,' answered Treebeard. "'More than that I cannot say. "'I do not know the history of wizards. "'They appeared first after the great ships came over the sea. "'But if they came with the ships I never can tell. "'Saruman was reckoned great among them, I believe.' He gave up wandering about and minding the affairs of men and elves some time ago. You would call it a very long time ago. And he settled down at Angrenost, or Isengard, as the men of Rohan call it. He was very quiet to begin with, but his fame began to grow. He was chosen to be head of the White Council, they say, but that did not turn out too well. I wonder now if even then Saruman was not turning to evil ways. But at any rate he used to give no trouble to his neighbours. I used to talk to him. There was a time when he was always walking about my woods. He was polite in those days, always asking my leave, at least when he met me, and always eager to listen. I told him many things that he would never have found out by himself, but he never repaid me in like kind. I cannot remember that he ever told me anything, and he got more and more like that. His face, as I remember it, I've not seen it for many a day, became like windows in a stone wall, windows with shutters inside. I think that I now understand what he's up to. He is plotting to become a power. He has a mind of metal and wheels, and he does not care for growing things, except as far as they serve him for the moment. And now it is clear that he is a black traitor. He has taken up with foul folk, with the orcs. Brum, hum! Worse than that, he has been doing something to them, something dangerous, for these Isengarders are more like wicked men. It is a mark of evil things that came in the great darkness that they cannot abide the sun. But Saruman's orcs can endure it, even if they hate it. I wonder what he has done. Are they men he has ruined, or has he blended the races of orcs and men? That would be a black evil.
Treebeard rumbled for a moment, as if he were pronouncing some deep subterranean Entish malediction.
Some time ago I began to wonder how orcs dared to pass through my woods so freely, he went on. Only lately did I guess that Saruman was to blame, and that long ago he had been spying out all the ways and discovering my secrets. He and his foul folk are making havoc now. Down on the borders they are felling trees, good trees. Some of the trees they just cut down and leave to rot. Orc mischief, that. But most are hewn up and carried off to feed the fires of Orthonk. There is always a smoke rising from Isengard these days. Curse him, root and branch! Many of those trees were my friends, creatures I had known from nut and acorn. Many had voices of their own that are lost forever now, and there are wastes of stump and bramble where once there were singing groves. I have been idle. I have let things slip. It must stop.
Treebeard raised himself from his bed with a jerk, stood up, and thumped his hand on the table. The vessels of light trembled and sent up two jets of flame. There was a flicker like green fire in his eyes, and his beard stood out stiff as a great besom.
"I will stop it," he boomed, "and you shall come with me. You may be able to help me. You will be helping your own friends that way, too. For if Saruman is not checked, Rohan and Gondor will have an enemy behind as well as in front. Our roads go together to Isengard."
"We will come with you," said Merry. "We will do what we can." "Yes," said Pippin. "I should like to see the White Hand overthrown. I should like to be there, even if I could not be of much use. I shall never forget Ugluk and the crossing of Rohan."
"Good, good," said Treebeard. "But I spoke hastily. We must not be hasty. I have become too hot. I must cool myself and think, for it is easier to shout stop than to do it."
He strode to the archway and stood for some time under the falling rain of the spring. Then he laughed and shook himself, and wherever the drops of water fell glittering from him to the ground, they glinted like red and green sparks. He came back and laid himself on the bed again and was silent. After some time the hobbits heard him murmuring again. He seemed to be counting on his fingers.
"Fangorn, Finglas, Fladriff, I,
he sighed. "The trouble is that there are so few of us left," he said, turning towards the hobbits. "Only three remain of the first Ents that walked in the woods before the darkness. Only myself, Fangorn, and Finglas, and Fladriff, to give them their elvish names. You may call them Leaflock and Skinbark, if you like that better. And of us three, Leaflock and Skinbark are not much use for this business. Leaflock has grown sleepy, almost tree-ish, you might say. He has taken to standing by himself half asleep all through the summer, with the deep grass of the meadows round his knees. Covered with leafy hair he is. He used to rouse up in winter, but of late he's been too drowsy to walk far even then. Skinbark lived on the mountain slopes west of Isengard. That is where the worst trouble has been. He was wounded by the orcs, and many of his folk and his tree herds have been murdered and destroyed. He's gone up into the high places, among the birches that he loves best, and he will not come down. Still, I dare say, I could get together a fair company of our younger folk, if I can make them understand the need. If I could rouse them. We are not a hasty folk. What a pity there are so few of us."
"Why are there so few when you've lived in this country so long?" asked Pippin. "Have a great many died?"
"Oh, no," said Treebeard. "None have died from inside, as you might say. Some have fallen in the evil chances of the long years, of course, and more have grown tree-ish. But there were never many of us, and we have not increased. There have been no entings, no children, you would say, not for a terrible long count of years. You see, we lost the Entwives."
"How very sad," said Pippin. "How was it that they all died?"
"They did not die," said Treebeard. "I never said died. "We lost them," I said. "We lost them and we cannot find them," he sighed. "I thought most folk knew that. There were songs about the hunt of the Ents for the Entwives, sung among elves and men from Mirkwood to Gondor. They cannot be quite forgotten."
"Well, I'm afraid the songs have not come west over the mountains to the Shire," said Merry. "Won't you tell us some more, or sing us one of your songs?"
"Yes, I will indeed," said Treebeard, seeming pleased with the request. "But I cannot tell it properly, only in short, and then we must end our talk. Tomorrow we have councils to call, and work to do, and maybe a journey to begin. It is rather a strange and sad story," he went on after a pause. "When the world was young, and the woods were wide and wild, the Ents and the Entwives, and there were Ent maidens then, ah, the loveliness of Fimbrethil, of Wandlim the light-footed in the days of our youth. They walked together and they housed together, but our hearts did not go on growing in the same way. The Ents gave their love to things that they met in the world, and the Entwives gave their thought to other things, for the Ents loved the great trees and the wild woods and the slopes of the high hills, and they drank of the mountain streams and ate only such fruit as the trees let fall in their path, and they learned of the elves and spoke with the trees. But the Entwives gave their minds to the lesser trees, and to the meads in the sunshine beyond the feet of the forests, and they saw the sloe in the thicket, and the wild apple and the cherry blossoming in spring, and the green herbs in the waterlands in summer, and the seeding grasses in the autumn fields. They did not desire to speak with these things, but they wished them to hear and obey what was said to them. The Entwives ordered them to grow according to their wishes, and bear leaf and fruit to their liking. For the Entwives desired order, and plenty, and peace, by which they meant that things should remain where they had set them. So the Entwives made gardens to live in, but we Ents went on wandering, and we only came to the gardens now and again. Then when the darkness came in the north, the Entwives crossed the great river, and made new gardens, and tilled new fields, and we saw them more seldom. After the darkness was overthrown, the land of the Entwives blossomed richly, and their fields were full of corn. Many men learned the crafts of the Entwives, and honoured them greatly. But we were only a legend to them, a secret in the heart of the forest. Yet here we still are, while all the gardens of the Entwives are wasted. Men call them the Brownlands now. I remember it was long ago, in the time of the war between Sauron and the Men of the Sea, the Zire came over me to see Fimbrethil again. Very fair she was still in my eyes, when I had last seen her, though little like the Entmaiden of old. For the Entwives were bent and browned by their labour, their hair parched by the sun to the hue of ripe corn, and their cheeks like red apples. Yet their eyes were still the eyes of our own people. We crossed over Anduin and came to their land, but we found a desert. It was all burned and uprooted, for war had passed over it. But the Entwives were not there. Long we called, and long we searched, and we asked all folk that we met which way the Entwives had gone. Some said they had never seen them, and some said that they had seen them walking away west, and some said east, and others south. But nowhere that we went could we find them. Our sorrow was very great. Yet the wildwood called, and we returned to it. For many years we used to go out every now and again and look for the Entwives, looking far and wide and calling them by their beautiful names. But as time passed, we went more seldom and wandered less far. And now the Entwives are only a memory for us, and our beards are long and grey. The elves made many songs concerning the search of the Ents, and some of the songs passed into the tongues of men. But we made no songs about it, being content to chant their beautiful names when we thought of the Entwives.
We believe that we may meet again in a time to come, and perhaps we shall find somewhere a land where we can live together and both be content. But it is foreboded that that will only be when we have both lost all that we now have. And it may well be that that time is drawing near at last. For if Sauron of old destroyed the gardens, the enemy today seems likely to wither all the woods. There was an elvish song that spoke of this, or at least so I understand it. It used to be sung up and down the great river. It was never an Entish song, mark you. It would have been a very long song in Entish, but we know it by heart and hum it now and again. This is how it runs in your tongue.
The Ent sings, when spring unfolds the beechen leaf and sap is in the bough, when light is on the wildwood stream and wind is on the brow, when stride is long and breath is deep and keen the mountain air, come back to me, come back to me, and say my land is fair.
And the Entwife replies,
when spring is come to garth and field, and corn is in the blade, when blossom like a shining snow is on the orchard laid, when shower and sun upon the earth with fragrance fill the air, I linger here and will not come, because my land is fair.
So the Ent sings,
when summer lies upon the world, and in a noon of gold, beneath the roof of sleeping leaves the dreams of trees unfold, when woodland halls are green and cool and wind is in the west, come back to me, come back to me, and say my land is best.
And the Entwife replies,
when summer warms the hanging fruit and burns the berry brown, when straw is gold and ear is white and harvest comes to town, when honey spills and apple swells, the wind be in the west, I linger here beneath the sun, because my land is best. When wind comes, the winter wild, that hill and wood shall slay, when trees shall fall and starless night devour the sunless day, when wind is in the deadly east, then in the bitter rain, I look for thee and call to thee, I'll come to thee again. When winter comes and singing ends, when darkness falls at last, when broken is the barren bough and light and labor past, I'll look for thee and wait for thee until we meet again. Together we will take the road beneath the bitter rain. Together we will take the road that leads into the west, and far away we'll find a land where both our hearts may rest.
Treebeard ended his song.
"That is how it goes," he said. "It is elvish, of course, light-hearted, quick-worded, and soon over. I dare say it is fair enough, but the Ents could say more on their side if they had time. But now I am going to stand up and take a little sleep. Where will you stand?"
"We usually lie down to sleep," said Merry. "We shall be all right where we are."
"Lie down to sleep?" said Treebeard. "Why, of course you do. I was forgetting. Singing that song put me in mind of old times. Almost thought that I was talking to young Entings, I did. Well, you can lie on the bed. I'm going to stand in the rain. Good night."
Merry and Pippin climbed onto the bed and curled up in the soft grass and fern. It was fresh and sweet-scented and warm. The lights died down, and the glow of the trees faded, but outside, under the arch, they could see old Treebeard standing, motionless, with his arms raised above his head. The bright stars peered out of the sky, and lit the falling water as it spilled onto his fingers and head, and dripped, dripped, in hundreds of silver drops onto his feet. Listening to the tinkling of the drops, the hobbits fell asleep. They woke to find a cool sun shining into the great court and onto the floor of the bay. Shreds of high cloud were overhead, running on a stiff easterly wind. Treebeard was not to be seen, but while Merry and Pippin were bathing in the basin by the arch, they heard him humming and singing as he came up the path between the trees.
"Ho, ho! Good morning, Merry and Pippin," he boomed when he saw them. "You sleep long. I've been many a hundred strides already today. Now we will have a drink and go to Entmoot."
He poured them out two full bowls from a stone jar, but from a different jar. The taste was not the same as it had been the night before. It was earthier and richer, more sustaining and food-like, so to speak. While the hobbits drank, sitting on the edge of the bed and nibbling small pieces of elf-cake, more because they felt that eating was a necessary part of breakfast than because they felt hungry, Treebeard stood, humming in Entish or Elvish or some strange tongue, and looking up at the sky.
"Where is Entmoot?" Pippin ventured to ask.
"Who? Eh? Entmoot?" said Treebeard, turning round. "It is not a place. It is a gathering of Ents, which does not happen often nowadays. But I have managed to make a fair number promise to come. We shall meet in the place where we have always met. Durndingle, men call it. It is a way south from here. We must be there before noon."
Before long they set off. Treebeard carried the hobbits in his arms as on the previous day. At the entrance to the court he turned to the right, stepped over the stream, and strode away southwards along the feet of great tumbled slopes where trees were scanty. Above these the hobbits saw thickets of birch and rowan, and beyond them dark climbing pine woods. Soon Treebeard turned a little away from the hills and plunged into deep groves, where the trees were larger, taller, and thicker than any that the hobbits had ever seen before. For a while they felt faintly the sense of stifling, which they had noticed when they first ventured into Fangorn, but it soon passed. Treebeard did not talk to them. He hummed to himself deeply and thoughtfully, but Merry and Pippin caught no proper words. It sounded like boom, boom, rum-boom, boo-da, boom-boom, da-da-boom-boom, da-da-boom, and so on with a constant change of note and rhythm. Now and again they thought they heard an answer, a hum or a quiver of sound that seemed to come out of the earth, or from boughs above their heads, or perhaps from the boles of the trees. But Treebeard did not stop or turn his head to either side.
This ends Disc 3.